regardless of your politics, at some point during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, you've probably thought, does a Supreme Court nomination have to be so partisan and so polarizing? Well, our neighbor to the north says no. Many Canadians can't name a sitting justice on their Supreme Court, and that's not because they're ignorant. Joining us now from Toronto is Adam Goldenberg, who's a lawyer and professor at the University of Toronto and was a clerk to former Supreme Court Chief Justice in Canada, Beverly McLaughlin. Adam, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So how does the process work in Canada?
So it's a lot less political. In Canada, the Prime Minister is the chief advisor to the Governor General, who's the Queen's representative in Canada. And the Prime Minister gives the Governor General a name, and that person is appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada. There's no necessity for any sort of legislative hearing or other process before the person is appointed, although different governments in the past have chosen by their own volition to have some kind of public hearing. The last couple of appointments by the current government have involved some questioning by members of parliament, although it's far more gentle than what Judge Kavanaugh just went through down there in the United States. And then there have been some public Q&As with law students and legal academics at the University of Ottawa. So it's a much more informal process, and none of it is constitutionally mandated. The only thing that the government has to do is pick a name.
But then how do you make sure that the government isn't just putting in people that agree with the government?
So there is no procedural means of making sure of that. They're simply constitutional norms and traditions that say the government doesn't do that. And history shows that Canadian governments don't do that. The culture of the Canadian Supreme Court is profoundly different, I'd suggest, than the culture of the U.S. Supreme Court. And the culture around judging in general is different in Canada than it is in the United States. You don't see the partisanship around judicial appointments here that you do there. So, for example, the last government, the Conservative government led by Prime Minister Stephen Harper, by the end of his time in office, had appointed 7 of the 9 judges on the Supreme Court of Canada, and nobody really could tell the difference. The government was still losing appeals on law and order issues. The Supreme Court struck down laws against sex work, against doctor-assisted suicide. It upheld a constitutional right to use medical marijuana, and it even struck down mandatory minimums, which was a significant part of the former government's platform. In the U.S., you would expect highly polarized political issues like that to be decided on 5-4 votes, almost on party line votes, like in a legislative body. In Canada, it's much harder to call how an individual judge will vote based on which party put them on the court.
Yeah, I've heard that almost all of them are considered swing justices.
Exactly. It's like, as imagine a court where you have of 9 judges, at least 7 at any one time are Anthony Kennedy.
Huh. Interesting. How powerful is the court in Canada?
So politically speaking, it is not really any less powerful than the Supreme Court is in the U.S. For all practical purposes, the Supreme Court is the final court of appeal for all constitutional questions in Canada. The one difference that you have in the Canadian context is there's a legislative override clause written into our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is the equivalent of the Bill of Rights. So whereas in the United States, if, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court says the legislature, Congress, cannot do X because it violates the First Amendment, in Canada, if a law were found to infringe Section 2B of the Charter, which is the equivalent of the First Amendment, the Parliament of Canada or a provincial legislature could invoke what's called the notwithstanding clause, Section 33 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And so the legislature does have the power to override the Supreme Court, although that power is used incredibly sparingly because there are political consequences to using it. And some commentators, particularly in the United States, suggest that this makes the form of judicial review we have in Canada qualitatively weaker than what you see in the United States. But for practical purposes, when the Supreme Court strikes down a law, it stays struck down.
A lot of the fights that involve the Supreme Court in this country have to do with how closely the justices are keeping their rulings to the Constitution, which was written hundreds of years ago. In Canada, your Constitution was written, what, in 1982?
So there are two parts of the Constitution.
Right.
Yeah, the Bill of Rights part, the Charter, was enacted in 1982. So there aren't really a lot of debates about, well, what were they really thinking?
Right.
What did this word mean all the way back in the 80s? There is much more academic work to be done when you're trying to figure out what a document that was enacted in 1789 is meant to say. That said, there are other provisions in the Canadian Constitution, the division of powers and the federalism provisions, which date back to 1867. And there are still other parts of the Constitution which exist in other statutes and that are even unwritten in the British tradition. So there is a lot of interpretation that does go on. That being said, in the U.S., the debate that happens now around constitutional interpretation and constitutional meaning is largely informed by forces in legal academia and in politics that were inspired by conservative backlash to rulings that the Warren Court made in the 1960s and that had continued then in the 80s, particularly when Ronald Reagan was in the White House. And there was a deliberate effort on the part of the Reagan Justice Department to choose judges whose judicial philosophy aligned with conservative policy outcomes. So the originalism that Antonin Scalia so famously expounded as a U.S. Supreme Court justice and as an academic before he was a judge, and that other judges like Robert Bork, who was almost a U.S. Supreme Court judge, were famous for expounding, were largely generated by a deliberate effort to create a conservative response to the Warren Court's liberalism and a string of decisions in the 60s, and we all know them, you know, Brown versus Board of Education, right. That was in the 50s, Miranda and Arizona, Gideon and Wainwright, decisions that the conservative movement in the United States took real exception to.
So you don't have something like that? You don't have a Federalist Society or a Heritage Foundation that gets in touch with the Prime Minister and says this is who you should appoint to the Supreme Court?
So we do have conservative legal organizations that do important work and that do the important job of making sure there is diversity in the legal academy and in the judiciary, but they don't have the same kind of influence that the Federalist Society does in the U.S. There is no, for example, equivalent to Leonard Leo, who's the executive vice president of FedSoc, who actually drafts a list that goes to the president that the president, in President Trump's case, chooses all of his Supreme Court picks from. There's nothing like that in Canada, nor is there the well-established pipeline for both liberal and conservative law students in the U.S. to become liberal or conservative judges, or first law clerks and then government lawyers and then private practice lawyers and then judges and then appellate judges and then Supreme Court justices. In Canada, there is nothing like that level of organization, nor has there ever been.
In the U.S., 50% of people identify as Republican or Democrat. In Canada, and this is amazing, just one in 600 people claim a party. So do you think that the Supreme Court is less partisan in Canada just because Canadians are less partisan?
Yeah, I do. So the statistic there, the one in 600 number, is an estimate. And what it represents is the number of Canadians that actually go out and join a political party. Mm-hmm. So in the U.S., if I were an American and I wanted to become a Democrat, I would simply say to no one in particular, I am now a Democrat. And or I would register as a Democrat, right, with the state government. In Canada, there is no equivalent to that. If you want to become a liberal in Canada, you have to join the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party actually recently made this dramatic move to open up its membership by getting rid of membership fees. The other parties, you actually have to pay money. And that, of course, is very different than in the United States. So very few Canadians actually take the step of formally affiliating themselves with a political party. That isn't to say that Canadians don't identify as being more or less aligned with one party or another. But in the U.S., when you say you're a Democrat, that means a lot more than saying I vote liberal in Canada. And so, yes, Canadians are less partisan than Americans are. And so Americans expect each other to be more partisan than Canadians expect each other to be. Judges who reach the Supreme Court in Canada, it doesn't even cross one's mind to think, in most cases, is this person a liberal? Are they a conservative? Because chances are they aren't in the technical sense of the term.
So as you watch the Kavanaugh process go on, what do you think? Which is a better system?
Well, I think the U.S. system is borderline insane. I know that and I say that with great respect to the U.S. constitutional tradition. The Senate has to advise and consent on these sorts of issues, and there is a constitutional imperative to do things the way that the U.S. does them. That being said, Senate Judiciary Committee hearings were not always this way. Both parties share responsibility for that. I mean, the Robert Bork hearings and the hearings around Clarence Thomas's appointments back in the 80s, these were the watershed moments in turning the Senate Judiciary Committee into the political madhouse that it is today around Supreme Court nominations. But I do think that when you have judicial appointments become such a partisan issue, there's a legitimacy problem for a high court. When people see 5-4 rulings on issues like gay marriage in Obergefell and Hodges, in campaign finance reform in Citizens United and Federal Election Commission, like more very recently on labor unions and the rights of non-labor union members to not pay union dues for political activities in the Janus case, which was just very recently decided. When these sorts of politically contentious issues, which are the subject of partisan contestation in the legislative context, are decided on 5-4 party line votes by the Supreme Court, it's no surprise that Americans take a judicial appointment to be like a lasting achievement for a Republican president to make the Supreme Court a Republican body for as long as the Republican members of the Supreme Court, and they are considered Republican, not just conservative, stay in that office. So how are you supposed to keep people trusting the decisions of a high court when they see it as an extension of politics? And in Canada, we've managed to avoid that partly by sheer luck, partly by different constitutional traditions that we have and different structures that we have in our constitution, and partly because our judges quite simply are less predictable than yours are.
But it is colder in Canada. You'll accept that.
Well, we'll see. Climate change, you know, we're going to have tourists in the Arctic pretty soon.
It's Adam Goldenberg, who is a lawyer and professor at the University of Toronto. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.